Right, hello, and welcome to another of our Sunday school lessons. I believe this is being recorded. I want to jump right in. Good morning if you're watching or listening to this in the morning. If not, whatever time of day that is. My air conditioning has just kind of cut down to a lower setting, so I'm going to jump right in before it kicks back up. But it's hot. It's going to be hot tomorrow. But we'll worship God nonetheless and be thankful for what we have. The ability to do that. Singing with Understanding, Theology of Hymn Singing. We have begun this third series of lessons, not on why we should sing, what we should sing, but now kind of on some of those other matters of how we should sing, the circumstances of singing in worship. And we began that study last week, and really the first answer that we gave to that question, how should we sing, is that we should sing congregationally. That's the default position of the New Testament. We sing as a congregation, and so that means, raises those questions that we raised and attempted to address last time on choirs, special music, worship teams, those type of things. But really, just the default position of the New Testament, obviously, is congregational singing, and that the early church was just every person was engaged in singing. That it's related to the idea of the priesthood of the believers, right? Unlike the Old Covenant, whereas most of the singing was relegated to a priestly Levitical group. Right now, all believers are priests, and so we all bring those spiritual sacrifices, including and really primarily our praise, according to 1 Peter 2, according to Hebrews 13, the sacrifice of our lips. That's what we bring, and we have that duty and that privilege as believers in the New Testament and as the congregation of believers as we come together in worship. So congregational. And so I had discussed the matters of choirs, of special music, all of that. And this was the slide that I had ended with last time, was bringing it back to you then. This does mean there is this individual responsibility, right? That each and every believer has this individual responsibility to engage in this aspect of worship, in this aspect of their priestly ministry as priests in Christ. And so, again, we have this responsibility, we have this duty, and it's a privilege. Again, we don't just have to have someone else sing for us. We can sing to God, and we ought to sing to God ourselves, whether we're good singers or not so good, whether we enjoy singing. And I know there are some of us, I am one, I grew up in a family that was quite musical, that sang. I remember road trips. Probably the majority of our, well, maybe not the majority of our road trips, but whenever we were taking long road trips, a good portion of those road trips would just be given over to singing, and singing normally, hymns, other type of sacred music. And so I enjoy it. I recognize there are some who aren't so good at singing. There are some who don't really enjoy singing so much. But then at the same time, don't let a choir, or don't even let your own insecurities excuse you from this duty or rob you of this privilege. And that's what I really want to emphasize. It is a privilege for all believers. We have that direct access as priests to the very throne of God in heaven through the mediation, not of a sinful human, but just of Jesus Christ, that perfect mediation. And so why would we let ourselves be robbed of that? And so I want to stick with this idea just for one more lesson and just talk a little bit more about this individual responsibility and how each of us as individual believers, New Testament Christians, can and ought to perform this duty, engage in this privilege of singing as a congregation to our God. And so I want to turn at this point to John Wesley. Sounds interesting. Some of you might actually know where we're going with this. What he has to say on this matter is pretty popular, even within Reformed circles, even though, again, Wesley had other theological differences and things like that. But I just want to turn, and I think just for this lesson, we'll flesh out a little bit of the instruction that he gives. I think it is helpful. There's helpful admonitions in John Wesley's, what's often referred to as his directions for singing. Now, if you've been part of our church for a while, quite a few years ago, Pastor Jim Renahan mentioned this, dwelt upon this for a little while, and I thought it'd be a good point to revisit that for those of you who are new to it, but even just to remind those of us who remember this, because I think that it is honestly something that we as a congregation can improve on, that we as a congregation can do better on. Each of us individually taking this responsibility of singing and singing in a way that brings the most glory to God and most edification to our believers. And that's really what John Wesley's directions for singing are all about. Just to give you a little bit of background for what this is, of course, you know, the Wesleys were very, very involved in hymnody. Charles Wesley, John Wesley, both of them writing hymns and collecting hymns. And I mean, I can't remember off the top of my head, but how many collections of hymns they actually published during their lives. It was at least one a year of collections of hymns, not just individual hymns, that they were publishing. And so it's almost insane to think about. But this, his directions for singing, which have become, I think, justly well known, originally were appended to the end of his 1761 collection of hymns called Select Hymns, full title, as you can see, Select Hymns with Tunes Annexed, designed chiefly for the use of the people called Methodists. This was published in 1761 originally, and this was at the very end. Now, this was in many ways a unique collection of hymns to a degree, but just a little bit about it, because it's pretty fascinating to look through. But in the preface, Wesley, John Wesley here, explains that this collection was intended to standardize the text and the tunes of Methodist hymnody. Now, again, at this point, John Wesley was kind of the head of this group of various, or this head of this organization of various groups, various churches that had had begun, that held to Methodism. I think at this point, you know, a lot of those groups had left the Anglican Church. Originally, they were formed within Anglican churches. But of course, the Wesleys had this really strong emphasis upon holiness, personal holiness, and personal engagement in worship. It's one of the things they had against the Anglican Church. And so they had written and collected a lot of hymns at this point. And so there were just a lot of these different groups and churches, Methodist groups and churches, that were, you know, singing some of the same hymns, but using different tunes or using various various forms of these texts and of these tunes. And Wesley just really wanted to standardize this. So he wanted to, he explains this all in his preface, that this was really just a hymnal for his group of churches, for the Methodists. He got what he considered to be the best of the texts of the hymns, and then also the most common and known, well-known tunes that accompanied those texts. And so he wanted it to be the case that it was pretty familiar. Like if you went from congregation to congregation, you would know this set of words sung to this exact text. Now, again, some people might view that as trying to be overly controlling and doing all this. I mean, even in the preface, he mentions how he's been working on this for 20 years to get something, and he tried to delegate it to other people, to musicians, but these musicians wanted to improve upon these tunes and change them, and he just wanted, no, absolutely just kind of what we're used to, and we're gonna sing this way, and this is going to be a standard for the Methodist congregations. And also it's relatively small. I think there's only about 130 some hymn tunes and then a few more hymn text. But it's really kind of an interesting little work, but it was, Wesley wanted this to be relatively affordable, relatively small and portable, just so the Methodists could make use of it, and this would be what we focus on in our worship. We can use some other things, but let's emphasize and prioritize these texts and these tunes. Interestingly, it consists of a first section with the hymn text, just kind of in that standard form, not accompanied with notes, not accompanied with music, and then a second section with the hymn tunes, and then he would refer back to sing this tune with this hymn or these hymns. Oftentimes there were multiple texts that would be assigned to one tune. But in between, interestingly enough, is this section. You can see this is where it begins. You see the little Roman numeral one there at the beginning. That it really, in between those two sections of the text and the tunes, there's an introduction, basically what it is, an introduction to reading music. And so you can see he goes through the notes of the various clefs. He even explains what clefs, or he calls them clefs, are. And then he'll go on to talk about, you know, the length of notes and even chord structures. It's really pretty fascinating. I won't take the time to go into it, although I think it's fascinating. But you can tell he's really wanting to standardize. He's really wanting to teach the Methodists not only what text to sing, but also what tunes to sing them to, and kind of standardize that within them. And so, again, as I said, at the end of this collection of hymns, however, are these directions. And the directions are just practical instructions that are addressed to the individual worshiper, so that, as he says, his singing may be the more acceptable to God as well as the more profitable to yourselves and others. And so, interesting, you know, he views what we see there in Ephesians and in Colossians about those kind of two focuses, right? The vertical focus on God, which is primary, but then also this horizontal focus on ourselves, but also on the edification of others, right? We address one another and admonish and instruct one another with psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. And so he has these seven, there's seven of them, really practical instructions that he gives. And so this is when it first appeared as an appendix to this collection of hymns. It was specifically for the Methodists. And yet after that, it got much more play and was published independently, and really has kind of been around ever since then. I've been to at least a couple fellow Reformed Baptist churches where they had taken these directions for singing and printed them off and then taped them in the front of their Trinity hymnal or whatever hymnal they're using. And they just realized these are beneficial. They're good reminders to us as we come to worship. And so that's what I want this to be as well. Just good reminders as we come together for worship and as we're taking this individual responsibility to participate in this act of worship. And again, as we've emphasized, this required, divinely ordained act of worship, and not just for some within the church, but for all within the church, that we might engage in it in a way that's most glorifying to God, most beneficial to ourselves and to our brothers and sisters in Christ. So you can see this here. It's small print, and it's in that old English kind of font. So I'll have them over here on the left of the screen as well, and just walk through them, and I'll make a few comments. But for the most part, we'll just let John Wesley speak for himself. So here's this John Wesley's directions for singing. The first direction that he gives, he says, learn these tunes before you learn any others. Afterwards, learn as many as you please. And then secondly, I'm going to take these first two together. Sing these tunes exactly as they are printed here, without alteration or mending them at all. And if you have learned to sing them otherwise, unlearn it as soon as you can. Kind of interesting to begin that way, but you can see, hopefully I gave you a little bit of the context with Wesley's desire for this collection of hymns in his preface, that he just really wants to standardize these things. And why does he want to standardize them? I don't think it's just that he wants to be in control of everything and micromanage everything within the Methodist organization. Now, again, if you know anything about the life of John Wesley, there probably were some times that he really tried to do that. But I, giving the benefit of the doubt, assuming the best of his intentions, I think I understand. I think these directions, while they might seem strange at first, they are intended to promote three things: familiarity, uniformity, and accessibility with the tunes that are used. Again, these first two are really directed toward the tunes, not so much toward the text. And why? In order that they might aid the worship and the singing of the church and not distract from it. A lot of you can understand that. If you come and you're singing a new hymn, especially to a new tune, and it's distracting. Now, even this coming Lord's Day, this is something I struggle with all the time as I'm picking out songs for our church to sing. You know, sometimes I really want to use this text, but particularly now that we're not using our hymnals as much, and so we don't have the tunes directly in front of us, if it's an unfamiliar tune, then I think, well, okay, is there another tune that's more familiar to us that we can sing this text to? Because then, again, it's something that you don't have to think as much about the tune. You don't have to try to follow it. You already know it. You're already familiar with it. And so you can focus on the text, which is where he's going to end up. Really, all these things are subservient to the seventh point. And so familiarity can be a great benefit in worship, right? If you're just constantly singing new hymns, and I know some of you who are new to our congregation might think that you're just singing new hymns all the time, introduced to new tunes, you know, but hopefully there's a degree to which we repeat things enough that we can become familiar with them. Or again, if it's something brand new, I'll try to set it to a different tune, or I'll try to send out the tune ahead of time so that we can be familiar, so that, as I always say, we can sing it unto greater edification. Uniformity. Now, again, there's a great benefit in uniformity as well. If each church or each congregation is singing the same text but to different tunes, and this is one of the problems you really had within Great Britain at the time, and you still have to a certain extent, is that they just have the text of their hymns and their hymnals, and each church will kind of pick whatever tune they want to sing it to. So you could go to a different congregation, be singing a hymn you think you know, but now it's to a totally different tune. And so Wesley really wanted to make those more uniform. And that's why hymnals over the ages have moved toward having kind of these standard hymn tunes that are picked for each hymn text. But also, Wesley was very concerned, and he viewed this in his preface as well, with accessibility. Right? He wants these tunes to be accessible to the ordinary worshiper. So like one who's not a trained musician, not one who doesn't really know how to read music, one who's not just a very practiced singer, right? So you know, a lot of these tunes, and we've talked about this in the past before as well, but they don't make huge leaps, or they're not requiring any, you know, incredible vocal technique that's just inaccessible to your ordinary person, right? You don't have to be a trained opera singer in order to sing these hymns, and I'll give an example in a second. But he really wanted this, right? Because he even said in his preface that he was complaining to these masters of music, as he called them, when he would bring this project to them and try to delegate it, that they would try to improve upon the tunes and sort of make them better, make them more musically, you know, elevated or whatever. And he didn't like that. He said, this is what we're used to. So just write these tunes down the way that we sing them, the way that we know them, because they're accessible, they're easy. You don't have to be a trained musician in order to sing them. And that really is, even still today, a very real and important consideration, right? Even some, you know, a lot of pop music, things that are used for a lot of contemporary Christian music, you might like them, but they're just not conducive to singing as a congregation. They're not easy for your average, you know, person in the pew to be able to sing. They're sort of made to be performance pieces, and there's a huge difference between performance pieces and congregational, you know, music. So that's really why he's emphasizing this so much. And I think even just applying this to our situation, it really is good to have one enduring, you know, collection, repertoire of hymns. We know these tunes, we know these words, and so when we sing them, you know, we really can sing them to greater edification. We're not being distracted by, this is too hard to sing, this is completely unfamiliar, or I used to sing this in the church and we sang it to this slightly different tune and all of that. That's why he says unlearn if you've learned it in a different way, unlearn it and then learn it this kind of standardized way as well. So I think, again, his heart in this is we want even the tunes of our music, something we'll go on to talk about a little bit more as well, to aid and not distract from the message of from our ability to understand and engage in our worship as well. Well, enough said with that. Let me give you just two examples. And this is, some of you might be upset with me for this, but I'm going to give you two examples. And I've chosen for this, O for a Thousand Tongues to Sing My Great Redeemer's Praise, which is a Charles Wesley hymn, so it seems appropriate. And again, I don't think the Wesleys sang it to either of these tunes. These are things that came much later. But I grew up with one tune for O for a Thousand Tongues to Sing. And it's the one that we have in our Trinity hymnal. I'll play it in just a second. Asmon, I think, is the name of the tune. And, you know, you're probably most familiar with it. I'm most familiar with it. When I went to New Zealand to do my internship, they had the kind of typical British form of hymnal where it was just the words. It wasn't the music. And when I got there, they sang O for a Thousand Tongues to Sing, but to a tune I had never heard before, but that I instantly loved. I loved it. And yet at the same time, I was completely lost. At least the first, you know, half a dozen times that I've sung it to this tune, I'm completely lost. I mean, even with the notes in front of me. And again, I'm not a sight reader. I'm definitely not the most trained musician in the world, but I can normally at least follow and see the intervals and the jumps and things like that. But even after that, because I sang it again at another Reformed Baptist church in the U.S. that used that tune, and they actually had the notes and everything, and I still got lost. And I just think for me, for someone who at least can somewhat read music, if I'm just getting lost, it's just distracting and it's difficult. And as much as I just sort of, by my musical taste, love the second tune, I still think the first tune is the best because it's just acceptable. I apologize. I think there's a little bit of noise going on in the back. I'm going to pause the recording. Okay, that's the first time that I have tried to pause the recording and resume it, so I hope that that works. So I apologize. But I was just saying these two tunes, one is, I just think, more accessible, and it's, you know, it's fitting enough for the tune, or for the text. And let me just give you an example, and we'll be kind of giving other examples when we get back to this. So just a word of warning and caution as well, is because I'm connected with the internet like I didn't used to be when I was at the church building, these are just embedded videos, so they're playing directly from the internet, from YouTube, and they're not like downloaded and put on here. So I just hope there's not a commercial for something that pops up, like a Joe Biden campaign message or something like that. If so, I'll just skip it, and hopefully it'll work. But this is the first tune. This is a tune we're familiar with. You can see it's a fairly simple tune. It's accessible. A second tune, and I can't remember off the top of my head what this tune is called, but again, I've sung it in a couple of different churches, and I really like it musically, but I just think for singing as a congregation, it's just too complex. It just requires a little bit too much, and you know, maybe you could take the time to learn it as a congregation, but again, if someone else joins in who's not familiar with it, it's going to be really difficult. And again, even I struggled with it. Now, this is a professional choir that's singing it, but it's beautiful. I'm going to give you two verses of this because I love it. Thank you. right. So, I mean, you can see that. I'm trying to progress here. There we go. But you can see, of course, that second one is much more ornate. It really is beautiful. I love it. But and you might be thinking, okay, is this just a choral arrangement of that hymn tune? No, that's how they attempt to sing it in these churches. You know, especially kind of that refrain. There's the men singing one melody, the women overlapping with a different melody. And you know, if a church can pull it off, fantastic. But I think for a lot of us, that would be pretty challenging. So that's just one example, and that's what I think what Wesley had in mind here, right? Let's not pick these ornate, let's not try to improve upon them, to make them, you know, as musically intricate as they could possibly be. Let's just choose tunes, standardize those tunes so that it's accessible and it's beneficial to everyone. All right, so number three, then, sing all. And this is where I really want to make some applications, but sing all. See that you join with the congregation as frequently as you can. Let not a slight degree of weakness or weariness hinder you. If it is a cross to you, take it up, and you will find it a blessing. See, this is something, again, with me personally, growing up in a singing family, growing up in a church where we sing all the time, growing up with church choirs and high school choirs and college choirs and all of that. This isn't something that I struggle with. I mean, to me, if we had five or six hymns every Lord's Day, I'd be perfectly happy with that, because I just enjoy it. Now, I know that there are just others who don't enjoy it, or for whom it's actually maybe even a bit of a difficulty for them to. I mean, either this matters of physical weakness, or just, you know, they don't feel that they have the best singing voice, or it's difficult for them to follow along with singing, you know, or so. But it says, let not a slight degree of weakness or weariness hinder you. And then if it is a cross to you, right, if this is even something that is a sacrifice for you, take up that cross and you will find it a blessing. So again, as we've already emphasized, singing is a duty, It is required of us. And as I mentioned last time, you know, I again, as someone who enjoys singing, who grew up singing, it's kind of surprising to me to look out sometimes and see people that are just sort of standing there. They're holding a hymn book maybe, but they're not singing. And again, I of course don't want to single anyone out. I hope that I'm not. But you know, again, it's just to recognize this is a duty. It's something that God has required of us. I mean, this is one of those places where, you know, whereas we're going to be okay meeting outside, accommodating some other things in our church life at this time, you know, if the government came out and said, no, absolutely no singing, you know, even if you're masked, even if you're outside, anything, you know, we would just have to take a stand and say, no, this is something that God has absolutely required us to do, part of his worship, and we're going to perform it. But if we're going to say that, then that means that each of us individually have to see it that same way. This is something that God requires of me. And again, not just requires of me, but this is a privilege that I have. And again, that's, I think, why there's that emphasis on congregational singing in the New Testament rather than on solo or choir performance, because it doesn't require you to be the most musically gifted or inclined person to engage. All of us can, and all of us should. Now, and all Christian worship, again, even if you view this as something that you struggle with, that you don't enjoy as much as other people just innately, recognize all Christian worship and obedience does involve a degree of sacrifice, right? It is, as Wesley puts it here, a cross to be taken up and borne, and yet it is attended with God's promise of blessing. I've got a couple of scriptures here. You know, Hebrews 13, and we've referenced this a couple of times in our study so far as well, but it talks about the praise of our lips as a sacrifice. And yes, Old Testament sacrifices, New Testament sacrifices, they were things that, to a greater or lesser degree, cost us something. Right? As David said, you know, I will not give to the Lord that which costs me nothing. And I would say, even if singing is something that is kind of costly or difficult for you, I would encourage you that probably makes it even more of a delight to God than for someone who just enjoys it innately. But notice here, and I don't just quote verse 15, but Hebrews 13, beginning with verse 12. More noise. Okay, so Hebrews 13, and picking up even just in verse 12, so Jesus also suffered outside the gate in order to sanctify the people through his own blood. Therefore, let us go to him outside the camp and bear the reproach he endured. For here we have no lasting city, but we seek the city that is to come. Through him, then, again, the context of kind of sharing his suffering and his sacrifice, through him, then, let us continually offer up, again, a sacrifice of praise to God, that is the fruit of lips that acknowledge his name. Do not neglect to do good and to share what you have, for such sacrifices are pleasing to God. Right? So even if it involves sacrifice, again, which all Christian worship and obedience does to a degree, yet it's pleasing to God, and we know we have his promise of blessing upon that. And I quote here also Philippians 4:4-7, which again, of course, is that admonition to rejoice always, and then in all things by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving to make our requests known unto God. Again, because singing, as we've been arguing, is kind of a subset of prayer. And again, what's the promise that's appended to that command to pray? It is the peace of God then will rule our hearts through Jesus Christ. Just to emphasize what Wesley is pointing out here, sing all of us individually, even if it's difficult for us, even if that's a bit of a cross to us. Number four, now this is old English language, it's really fun, but sing lustily and with good courage. Beware of singing as if you were half dead or half asleep, but lift up your voice with strength. Be no more afraid of your voice now, nor more ashamed of its being heard than when you sung the songs of Satan. Now, lovely. But lustily, again, Old English, what does it mean? You probably can figure out it's in a way that's healthy, that's energetic, that's full of strength and of power, right? So it's this energetic singing, right? So not just kind of sitting there mouthing along to the words, you know, hardly making a sound itself, but singing lustily, singing with heart, singing with energy, with engagement with what we are singing. Now, and what he does here, actually, but lift up your voice with strength, you see that, that's just a quotation of Isaiah 40 and verse 9, which is talking about the daughters of Zion, who behold your God, lift up your voice with strength. Lift it up, be not afraid, right? Say unto the cities of Judah, behold your God, right? So there's this emphasis there on the singing, but with this strength, with vigor, right? Not being afraid, not being timid to announce the praises of God or the, you know, his coming. And it's not just Isaiah 40, I mean, he uses that language there, but think how many times in the Psalms we are admonished to sing to God and to praise him, but with energy, with strength, strength, with a degree of, yes, volume that we are to praise our God. Now, again, I could quote ad nauseum here, but Psalm 33, 1-3, shout for joy to the Lord, O you righteous. Praise befits the upright. Give thanks to the Lord with a lyre. Make melody to him with a harp of 10 strings. Sing to him a new song. Play skillfully on the strings with loud shouts. Right? So even just this idea, now again, we're going to temper this with the next one, but, you know, there should be this engagement, right? We're just not so focused on, oh, is someone going to hear me and I'm ashamed of my voice being heard, but just singing, and singing with gusto, singing lustily, you know, in praise to our God. Psalm 66, again, we could just quote the Psalms at length here, but Psalm 66, shout for joy to God, all the earth, sing the glory of his name, give him glorious praise, right? It's something that, how can you give God glorious praise if you're just kind of sitting there sort of mumbling the words as we sing? Verse 8, you know, bless our God, O people, let the sound of his praise be heard, right? Let it be heard. Again, God doesn't, again, just look upon the externals. Oh, how perfectly is this person carrying the tune or doing all of that? No, he's pleased with our praise when we sing it joyfully, when we shout it unto him, when we let the sound of his praise actually be heard, right? I could go on, but again, even just when you get to those commands in Ephesians and Colossians, but particularly in Ephesians chapter 5, verses 18 and 19, and do not get drunk with wine, for that is debauchery, but be filled with the Spirit, right? So it's just something that's just a strong moving of the Spirit within us, you know, and how does that express itself? Addressing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody to the Lord with your heart. Right, not just in your heart, I think, but with your heart. It's just something that's hearty. And again, there's different hymns that we're going to sing that bear different moods, and so maybe we'll sing some more quietly than others. But as a whole, as we're singing the praises of our God, why would we not do that with energy and with some gusto? And then the point that I think Wesley wisely brings up here says, be no more afraid of your voice now, nor more ashamed of its being heard than when you sung the songs of Satan. Now, songs of Satan, maybe that's a little bit extreme language just for secular music, right? We can sing secular music and enjoy secular music and all, and that's fine. But, you know, what are our favorite secular songs when it comes on the radio and we just, you know, belt it out? Whether there's someone in the car with us or not, whether there's someone around or not, you know, we sing it because we love it. I mean, that should be something that we take into consideration. How enthusiastically am I singing these secular songs? How enthusiastically am I singing the songs of praise to God? And what does that tell about where my heart is, where my mind is? Again, we sing songs about things that are important to us. And I think we sing songs more lustily, more with good courage about the things that we are most passionate and most excited about. So it's a good reminder and a good question for us all to ask. Fifth, in sort of a counterpoint, as I say, to the previous point about singing lustily, he also says sing modestly. And I think this is a good, important point. Yeah, we need to sing heartily. We need to sing with that. That heart, but don't bawl so as to be heard above or distinct from the rest of the congregation, that you may not destroy the harmony, but strive to unite your voices together so as to make one clear melodious song sound. So again, on the one hand, yeah, sing lustily, but sing with that heart, sing with that enthusiasm, because again, what are we singing about, and what should rouse our desire to sing and praise more than God and Christ and everything he's done for us? But at the same time, sing modestly. And I think this is an admonition. The previous one is an admonition to those who maybe are a little bit more shy about their voice, their ability, and so they're afraid for other people to hear them. This is the opposite. This is for those who really, you know, think that they have a good voice and they can really sing out and, you know, probably in some ways are tempted to be heard above the rest of the congregation or distinct from the rest of the congregation. Right? We shouldn't desire that either. You know, as with all other acts of worship, we should not be seeking to please ourselves or to impress others. We should just be focused on God and on his worship. So, yeah, you don't want to just sing so loudly or in such an ostentatious way that we're drawing attention to ourselves at the expense of the others around us or the worship of God that they're engaging in. So yeah, sing modestly. Make sure you're measured. You're not singing, you know, however many decibels louder than the rest of the congregation. You're still singing heartily, but you're just not drawing attention to yourself or distracting others. And so that's what I would say kind of related to this is the question of, you know, whether in congregational singing we should just be singing the melody or we should just be singing, you know, the parts as well. I'm one of those people that loves singing the tenor line, loves singing, you know, some of the other parts. Occasionally I'll slip down to the bass line. Even on occasion, if I feel like the tenor line is too boring, I'll try out the alto line. But, you know, I enjoy that. But again, in worship, what are we doing here? You know, should we just all be singing in unison? Or is there an occasion for the parts? And And I would say, again, this is something the scripture doesn't address directly, but if we're trying not to be heard above or distinct from the rest of the congregation, is it okay to sing the part? And I would just say, you know, key question to ask yourself is my singing part aiding the worship of myself or others, or is it distracting from my worship or from others? And for one who sings parts, sometimes if it's a part I'm kind of unfamiliar with, then I can just be so focused on trying to figure out that part that I'm just not paying attention to the words. My heart isn't engaged in the worship of God. And there have been times where I've been doing that and just thinking, why am I doing this? You know, if I really want to learn this part, let me go home after the service and bang it out on the piano myself and try to figure it out so that next time I can sing it without so much of a distraction. Or, you know, even am I distracting other people around me because they hear me trying to stumble through this part? Or if I'm just singing it really, really well, is that something that also is just distracting others from worship? But I think, you know, singing a part, if it's done, you know, you're familiar, it's easy for you, you can still focus on the words, focus on the message, focus upon God in worship, then that's fine. You're not just, you know, distracting others from it. So it's just that question. Again, when I think a congregation is singing and there's some of those parts joining together, it can be a very beautiful thing. But there are times when, again, I generally at our church lead the singing, and so I'm always just singing the melody in that case. I'm not going to switch into a part. That would be incredibly distracting. But even sometimes when I've been part of the congregation and we're singing a tune that maybe isn't quite as familiar to everyone or something, I'll just, you know, as much as I want to sing the part, I'll just switch over and sing the melody just to aid in the primary part of the singing of the congregation. So that's all I'll say on that matter. But again, just as long as you're doing it modestly, you're remembering the purpose of worship. Sing the melody, sing the part. Those can be beneficial. But just check your own heart motive in doing that. And then number six, sing in time. Now, again, this is something that I think probably was more of a problem in Wesley's day than maybe it is in our day, because now we've got amplification, right? We've got pianos that are hooked into the sound system. Everyone can sing. They can kind of keep the time based on that. Of course, we'll talk about instruments next time. But sing in time. Whatever time is sung, be sure to keep with it. Don't run before or stay behind it, but attend close to the leading voices and move therewith as exactly as you can. And take care that you sing not too slow. This drawling way naturally steals on all those who are lazy, and it is high time to drive it out from among us and sing all of our tunes just as quick as we did at first. And now, again, I think this is something that was somewhat a little bit more specific a problem to Wesley in his time. But again, it's just really the concern is for uniformity, it's for edification, right? Don't cause distractions by singing too fast, too slow, compared to the rest of the congregation. So I'll just leave it up there, although, again, there's something to be learned. Lastly, and most importantly, above all, Wesley writes, sing spiritually, by which he means that have an eye to God in every word you sing. Aim at pleasing him more than yourself or any other creature. In order to this, or you know, to this end, attend strictly to the sense of what you sing and see that your heart is not carried away with the sound, but offered to God continually. So shall your singing be such as the Lord will approve of here and reward when he cometh in the clouds of heaven. Again, just a lot of what he says here brings it back to the purpose of singing in worship in the first place, and then to the importance of singing in worship, right? This is something that pleases our God, and it's something that, if it's genuinely done in his worship, will be rewarded, approved of, even at his return. But singing spiritually, and the emphasis here is on the message of the words, and that's what's paramount, right? The truth that's being spoken, the truth that's being confessed, the truth that's being conveyed, the truth that is being you know, instructed and admonished to our brothers and sisters in Christ, that's paramount. Again, all these other things, the tune, the timing, all of that is how loudly we sing, all of that is subservient to the message. And when you get that perspective, I think that answers so many of the questions that are still out there in this day and age? You know, does the tomb enhance, does it aid, or does it distract from the message that is being conveyed? And that's what we want. We want people to focus as much as possible on the truth, right? Because that is what is going to edify us, is what's going to glorify God. Again, John 4:23, Christ's words to the woman at the well, you know, the Father is seeking those who will worship him in spirit and in truth. And yes, spirit, we want to sing lustfully, we want to sing heartily, but we also want to worship him according to truth. And 1 Corinthians 14:15, we want both, right? The worship with the spirit, worship with the mind. So the message of the words is paramount. Everything else ought to serve and enhance that, and both the glory of God and the edification of ourselves. And so just a reminder that if we're going to think spiritually, if we're going to maintain an eye to God in every word we sing, if we're going to, you know, attend strictly to the sense or the meaning of what we sing, it is going to require effort and intention. And really, that's the case with every aspect of worship. It's not passive for me to sit back and kind of engage, but my mind was turned off. No, no part of worship are you allowed to do that. Not in the prayers, not in the scripture reading, not in the message, and not in the singing. Yes, it's going to require effort and intention. We need to come with hearts prepared, with minds that are ready to pay attention to every word that we're singing and sing that unto God. But as with, again, every other aspect of worship, the more we put into it, the more we will get out of it, the more we will be blessed by it. You know, as Christ says of the preaching of the word in Mark 4:24, pay attention to what you hear. Pay attention to it. Like, give your attention to it, because with the measure that you use, it will be measured back to you. Right? The more attention, the more focus that you give to the preaching of the word, then the more blessing you will receive in return. The same is true with our singing. The more effort, the more intention, the more focus on the message, on the truth that we sing, the more we are focused on God in our singing and directing our singing to him, then the more blessing we'll receive from it, and the more glory God will receive from it as well. So there you go, just some practical directions for singing from John Wesley. I hope that that's helpful, but just to review, you know, learn these tunes before others, sing them exactly as they're printed, but then even more focusing, sing all of us, sing lustily, sing heartily, sing modestly, sing in time, and above all, sing spiritually. And may God help each one of us to sing in such a way. Now, I'll kind of officially end there, but for those of you who are a little bit more, I don't know, visual, those of you who are of the current generation and you can't abide blocks of text, not intimidating, this is just something I'm just putting up for fun, really, more than anything. But this is a visual representation of some of Wesley's rules of singing that some other, you know, modern Methodists put together. But to kind of summarize it in this way, I'll just point out some things if you can see my pointer. So learn this, not that. Learn this, what's easy for all to sing, songs that keep us focused. Right? You can see that. And then not this, easy for pop stars to sing. Right? Pop stars, but not for everyone. And then avoid endless solos that make us check out. Right? So that's just the emphasis on singing all and making the tunes accessible. Sing all here, right? All means all. So whether you're an opera singer or whether you're some guy that just can't really sing all that well, yes, you too, right? Don't be afraid. You sing other things. Sing the praises of God. It's about worshiping community. Sing out, right? So that's sing lustfully, sing heartily, less like sleeping. And then this just made me laugh. More like how you sing Frozen when alone in the shower. Sing Let It Go. For those of you of young kids, you'll appreciate that. But again, it's that point. How heartily do we sing these other songs that we really like versus how we sing in worship? But at the same time, don't get crazy. That's, you know, sing modestly. And then this, I put a block in front of because I think that was supposed to be a representation of Jesus, and I don't really understand why. It says you're not trying out for the voice, right? Yeah. Again, you're not auditioning. You're not trying to impress people. You're just singing to God. So sing out, but don't get crazy. And then pace is the trick. I guess this is the one I'm timing. Somewhere between Xanax and Adderall. So yeah, we just aim for that. That's edifying. It's not going to put us to sleep, but also isn't just too rapid that we can't keep up. Sadly enough, he misses the main point on this graphic, which is singing spiritually, right? Again, we're singing to God more than anything else. But at any rate, I'll end there. Again, hope this was edifying, as a good reminder to us, or an introduction to Wesley's directions for singing, and that as we sing, God will help us put these into practice. All right, Lord willing, I will come back next week.